blood conflict between Israel and the Arab world had lasted too long, and that the time for normalization had come. And something to the effect of, you know, us Saudis and the Gulf states plus Egypt and Jordan realize that the age of going to war with Israel is over. If this is true, what are your thoughts about this?
Well, it is true. And it's not only Saudi Arabia now. It's not only Saudi Arabia now. It is Bahrain, where the head of the Bahrainian government said that Israel is part of the Middle East, and it's here to stay. And it's time for us to create the bridges that will bring about peace in the long run. And Israel is, it doesn't mean that they're going to establish an embassy in Jerusalem, but they did talk about an embassy in what they call Palestine. So this is very interesting. This is groundbreaking, and this is why the meeting in Bahrain was so important, even though it may not lead to a peace treaty between the Palestinians and the Israelis, even though it may not lead to any kind of sort of resolution between the Palestinians and the Israelis. It was a way to open the doors to more normalized relations between Israel and some of its Arab neighbors. And that is a big deal.
We cannot let their voices stifle our cause. This political crisis puts our head in their jaws. History is upon us. We've seen this before. We can never allow freedom to exit our shore. Well, good afternoon and welcome to the Trump Chronicle. I'm your host, Ray Brookstein. Ladies and gentlemen, over the past few months, I focused time to bring to light some of the critical issues and difficulties facing Israel and the Middle East region in general. Yankee Farber and Ilana Friedman are with me again today as key commentators to help us understand the dynamics and what's happening on the ground. Yankee Farber is born and bred in Israel. He's an activist and a news reporter. Ilana Friedman is an intelligence and international security analyst, author, who also hosts a Wednesday news hour on the America Out Loud platform. So welcome, Yankee, and welcome, Ilana.
Hi, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be back.
I'm glad to have you back. It's been good the last few times to really get us up to snuff with, you know, the perspective from the ground and, you know, understanding the dynamics and the difficulties in this region. So I want to get the ball started, Yankee. And, you know, while there are always threats from outside forces that are determined to annihilate the Jewish people and Israel, it appears that internal battles are going on right now to form a new government. What's going on?
It's a bit complicated, so I'll try to explain it to the people, especially to the American people, because in America such a thing could never happen.
Okay.
So there was an election in Israel about 3 months ago, and Prime Minister Netanyahu could not form a government because he only had 60 seats. And in Israel, there is 120, so he needed one more. Now, he didn't have one more. So there's two options. Either someone from the left is going to form a government, and that could not happen because Netanyahu would never join to a left government. And also, the Orthodox community, the Orthodox parties, will never join a left party. They did it before, it was a big mistake, and they'll never do it again. So there's two options. Either we go into another election, either somebody else from Likud party, people should get it straight, somebody else from the Likud party, he could be Ner Barkat, he was the ex-mayor of Jerusalem, he's in Likud, he could be Israel Katz, he was the minister of transport before, he could be anybody else from the Likud. But a Likud party is a democratic party, and I am part of it, and we vote our chairman. So we voted Netanyahu on the head of the Likud. So we are not going to give somebody else from the Likud to inform a government, because we didn't vote for Nir Barkat or Israel Katz or anybody else to be the prime minister. We voted for Netanyahu. So there was no choice, and Israel is going to another election.
And when will that happen?
This is going to happen on the 17th of September, of the 9th of September. So 45 days before the election, on the 1st of August, 45 days before, all the parties will be closed. And then the game will start. Now, there's something people don't realize. There is Ehud Barak. Ehud Barak was a prime minister in Israel in 1999. He was prime minister for 1.8 months. That's it. Just over 1.5 years. He was the worst prime minister in Israel ever. He couldn't last 4 years. He could only last 1.8 months. This is nothing in an Israeli term of being a prime minister. He did a lot of mistakes. So he went away. Now he came back. The guy's 77 years old. He has very, very a complicated background. He was friendly with Harvey Weinstein. He was friendly with other people. And he was investigated by the police a long time ago. And he came out clean because his people kept quiet in the investigation. You could keep quiet in the investigation. So he got millions of dollars from the Wexner Foundation, the American Wexner Foundation. No one knows why. What was the money for? He doesn't want to say. And also he got about $500,000 from Martin Schlaff, Jewish billionaire in Austria, who gave him a lot of money, and the money never came back. So this is the guy is trying to compete with Netanyahu. So in the coming election, we're going to have the Blue-White Party, very big party. We're going to have Ehud Barak, and we're going to have all the right-wing parties and another few left-wing parties. So what the Israelis are trying to do now is the right people are trying to get together, and the left people are trying to get together. So it's a bit too early now to say who is going to be with who. But after the 1st of August, if we speak again, I'll just point out all the parties that are running. And then we can be much more smarter, and we can actually work out a government. Netanyahu has a better choice to win and be prime minister than the one before.
Well, certainly, we definitely will want to have you on about that time. The whole purpose why I built this into the Trump Chronicle, my weekday show, is so we can be updated periodically. Now, Ilana, you know, that this sounds very familiar when he's talking about Barak being a previous government official. He is about 77 years old. He wants to oppose Netanyahu, as Yankee is pointing out. It seems eerily similar to like something that Joe Biden is bringing to the table against Trump. Do you see any similarity here, or is there more to it?
Well, I think that Ehud Barak is showing his age, but I am hesitant to underestimate his popularity in certain corners. He's clearly corrupt. He's clearly not the man he was when he was studying economics and technology in Hebrew University and Stanford University. He's also, you know, he's a lieutenant general. It's just the highest rank in the Israeli military, and he was one of the two most highly decorated soldiers in Israel's history.
Okay.
He also was commander that. As a lieutenant general, he was commander-in-chief of the Israeli Armed Forces, and he was Israel's 10th prime minister for a very short time.
So there's definitely a certain amount of respect.
Exactly, and among certain people who don't want to look at him as corrupt or incapable, he was Israel's minister of foreign affairs and minister of defense. So he has a very credible background. But on the other hand, as Yanky said, he was a terrible prime minister, and he created more problems than he solved. He actually negotiated with Arafat for a peace treaty, and it never happened.
Can you take a moment to just tell us who Yasser Arafat was, for those people that may not know?
Yasser Arafat was the pretender to the Palestinian history that was supposed to go back thousands of years, and he was the pretender to the leadership of that. He actually made up Palestinian history, but he did become the head of the Palestinian Authority, and he was a terrorist, unmistakable terrorist. He was responsible for the death of hundreds of Israelis, and he paid the terrorists. He may not have carried out all the terrorist attacks himself. He didn't, but he paid other people to do it. He was very, very happy to send other people's children to be suicide terrorists. He made that quite clear. And he was the kind of guy who would speak to the American people or to English-speaking people about peace, but then he would speak in Arabic to his people, and he said in blood and...
Yeah, he said something on Arabic, and then he said something different on English.
I want peace in English, but in Arabic he said, we want war. Wow. And he told them to send their children to be suicide terrorists, to kill Israelis, to kill Jews.
Yeah, and today, just today, somebody that was very, very friendly with Ehud Barak 12 years ago, his name is Eldad Yaniv. Eldad Yaniv, everybody knows him in Israel. He's a famous lawyer. And he worked with Ehud Barak 12 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago. And he was very friendly with him. And they had a massive fight. They did not speak for 12 years. And Eldad Yaniv said about Ehud Barak very, very bad things, that he's equal, that he took money from this guy, from that guy. And he said that if they would have done it in these days, Ehud Barak would go to jail with them. He said it on himself. I would go to jail with Ehud Barak if we would have done what we did years ago. And you know what happened today? They got together, they made peace, and they're going to run against Netanyahu. So Eldad Yaniv keeps telling everybody in the last 12 years that Netanyahu has a problem with the police, his investigation, he's not an innocent man, and Ehud Barak is a big thief. He took money from people without telling anything to the government, without paying tax. No one knows where the money is gone. And now they make peace together so they can fight Netanyahu. This is crazy. So if you're against Netanyahu, then you're fine. If you're not against him, then you're a bad guy. People, so many people trying to get down Netanyahu. And I can say one thing as someone that I believe in God. Only God keeps Netanyahu on trail, on his foot, because there's so much power trying to get him, to take him down. And so far, Netanyahu is doing very well.
Well, you know, conservatives feel that the same way, that God brought Donald Trump to the White House and that God will keep him in the White House. So the similarities just are unbelievable. Now, is it possible, I've heard this term of dissolving the Knesset. Is that even possible? What in the world is that? Yankee.
Well, Israel is going to another election and everything starts from scratch. The only question is if the right-wing parties will be clever enough to run all together so to make sure they go past, because it's very important to know every party who runs to the Knesset needs to have minimum 140,000 people voting for them to get four seats. So you need 140,000. And if you want 3-4 right-wing parties, nobody will make it. So the left will win. So that's why they all need to go together. When they go past, they go into the Knesset, then they can start fighting, they can divide themselves, they can do whatever they want, but they must go together. And this is what Netanyahu is doing now. He's working very hard to get all the right-wing parties go together.
Does any of this affect national security issues?
No.
Or is this all behind the scenes?
No, because the government keeps keeps working. Netanyahu keeps working with the same government he had before the election. So, and maybe a few little changes, but it doesn't affect anything. Not the police, not the army, because the army is completely... actually, Netanyahu is in charge of the army. He's the Minister of Defense now anyway. So it doesn't affect anything, not that I see anyway.
And any conflicts on the ground right now that we should be aware of?
No. It's better. It's good. And today Israel announced that there is a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas, and nobody is shooting anybody. And it's quiet at the moment, and hope it's going to stay like that. At the moment, things are looking very good.
Okay, Alana, your thoughts on that?
I wish I could be as optimistic as Yankee is. We've never had a permanent ceasefire with Hamas because they keep breaking it. They send over fire balloons, or they send over a rocket, or they do something to disrupt the ceasefire that the many ceasefires that we have had that have been instrumental in helping them to rearm themselves and to reorganize themselves. So I don't have much faith in this one either.
Okay. On that note, we're going to take a short break.
Spreading the out loud truth from sea to shining sea. AmericaOutloud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. The goal is to deliver a message of truth, inspiration, and hope to the world. To unite people from all backgrounds and beliefs in an effort to advance humanity. We are the vision of the voices. Welcome to the new era in communications. America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Alana, do you have any other reasons to be a little pessimistic?
Yes. First of all, Hamas is never going to agree to a peace treaty with Israel or any kind of peace solution with Israel because they are grounded in the concept that Israel needs to be destroyed. It's in their charter. It's in their first charter and it's in their second charter that Israel needs to be destroyed. That land belongs to them and they want to march to Jerusalem. That's what all these demonstrations on Fridays at the Gaza border are about. They call it the March of Return. They want to, as they say, return to Jerusalem and reclaim the entire land that is now Israel for Hamas, for Palestinians. The problem is that there's already a state there. Israel is a sovereign state, a very strong one, and there's no way that it is going to commit national suicide. So the problem is that there is no possibility of peace if one side doesn't want it.
Well, you need it. All always takes two to tango, and if one side is not going to come to the table, it's just never going to happen. I mean, That Donald Trump would love to see what he can do, and Jared Kushner, and you know, it's the president has gotten zero to none when it comes to credit for anything that he does internationally. I wanted to ask you so that people understand. Where is Gaza and what's happening?
All right, before we get there, I'd just like to make a comment about this meeting in Bahrain.
Okay.
Because it was monumental. And you're talking about Trump trying to initiate a peace treaty. And it is different. But it is, in my opinion, doomed to failure because it's an economic peace. It's an economic part of his peace plan. And what the Palestinians will tell you is that this is not about economics. It's about ideology. It's about Islam. It's Islam 101 that Muslims who are represented in this case by the Palestinian Authority and Hamas, their whole view is that Islam should be the religion of the entire world. So they don't care about the economics. And if you look at the PA, if you look at the West Bank, for example, or you look at Gaza, far worse, the leaders of Hamas and the Fatah, the Palestinian Authority, they're keeping their own people in poverty while they enrich themselves. There is no interest in real governance. So the economics are irrelevant to them, and that's why they didn't go to the meeting. So I just want to say that with all his good intentions, I'm afraid that Trump's initiative is going to fail because it doesn't have partners to come to the table. And so that's my comment on that. Now, you wanted to know where Gaza is.
Yes, tell us about
Gaza. If you look at a map of Israel, Israel is very tiny. It's the size of maybe Vermont. And so then you look at the map of Israel, and in the southwest corner of Israel, there's an even tinier section, which is Gaza. It's right on the Mediterranean, and it's in the southwest corner of Israel. The part of Israel that's on the Mediterranean. Israel goes down further south to the Gulf of Eilat or the Gulf of Aqaba. But this part of Israel, which is on the Mediterranean, the southwest corner is Gaza.
And it's known as the Gaza Strip?
Yeah, because it's a kind of an elongated rectangle.
And who lives there? And why is there so much conflict?
Well, people who call themselves the Palestinians live there. That's a conversation for another day. But they live there, and they live under the thumb of Hamas, whom they elected to rule them in what Jimmy Carter called a free and fair election. And it was to an extent, but not completely. But anyway, Hamas won the election. And mostly because I think that they misrepresented themselves, and they also made a very big deal of the corruption which exists in the Palestinian Authority. And they were right. It's a very corrupt operation in the West Bank. But at the same time, it didn't talk about their own corruption, which is even worse. So
you mentioned
They have taken, let me just say this one thing, they have taken what was largely a secular society with a significant Christian population and turned it into a Muslim society, a Muslim country, area that is governed under Sharia law, and many of the Christians have left.
You mentioned a moment or two ago Jimmy Carter, and he just seems that he's been in the news a little lately. You know, kind of piping up, I don't know why. Was he involved back in the 70s with Arafat and Menachem Begin? Was he part of that, which you're talking about, when this Palestine Authority started to take shape? Was he involved in this, Carter? I'm just trying to remember my history a little bit.
Jimmy Carter has been involved in one way or another for a very long time. I remember when I was in Israel, and he came to Israel as president.
Right.
And he came for a visit. But he has been an Islamophile for a very long time. And he really always sided with the Palestinians against Israel. He came over and said, you know, with the claim that he was a born-again Christian, and he was taught as a child, this is what he said at the time, he was taught as a child to honor the people of Israel and the Jewish people. But he didn't do that as president, and it was one of the reasons why a lot of Jews voted for him. But he didn't do it as president. He really favored the Palestinians, and we call them Arabs at the time. And he hasn't changed. He's gotten worse, in fact.
You know, I read recently, and you mentioned in the first segment about balloons. What are these incendiary balloons?
About a year ago, Gazans got an idea. You know, they were having, from March 30th, 2018, rather, they started this March of Return. They called it the Great March of Return. It was really organized by Hamas, although at the beginning they claimed that there was a private organization that was organizing this. But it turns out that Hamas was really behind it from the beginning. And they have been marching on large demonstrations, sometimes riots. They throw incendiary devices and IEDs and everything across the barrier at Israeli soldiers. Even shoot at them, all kinds of things, burning tires, lots of things going on there. And it's very disruptive, and it's chaotic, and it's also doing terrible damage to the environment. But Hamas doesn't care about that. And then at some point last summer we started to see that Gaza, the people in Gaza figured out, these are Hamas people, the members of Hamas, young kids, meaning teenagers, figured out that if they they blew up a balloon with helium, and then they tied a string to it and tied a flaming rag to the string, then they could let it go, and the breezes from the Mediterranean, which is on the west, which would blow eastward so that the balloons would be carried into Israel, finally land in Israeli fields and forests and nature reserves, and set fire to whatever they landed on.
Wow.
And they destroyed thousands of acres of wheat fields, of protected forests, which, you know, when Israel was founded, this was all desert.
Correct.
All of it. And Israel has worked tirelessly over the last 70 years to build beautiful forests, wonderful nature reserves where they have nurtured animals that are recorded in the Bible, and they tried to reestablish these populations of animals and birds. And these fires not only destroyed their habitats, but it killed thousands of animals, mm-hmm. of these protected animals that have been nurtured for so long. So, the Arabs, the Palestinians who sent these balloons, actually tied one of the flaming rags to the leg of a rare hawk and sent him over into Israel. He got tangled in a tree and he burned to death.
Oh my.
You know, these are, fire is a weapon. It is being used as a weapon. And why Israel does not respond to this in a serious way is absolutely beyond me.
I mean, we're talking about fields and forests.
In a city, in a town. One of them landed in the backyard of a school. People could be engulfed in flames. This is what they're aiming for.
I've never heard of anything like this. It's just unbelievable.
No, wait, it's worse. It gets worse because they figured out that if they soak the rag in a slow burning liquid, then what will happen is as the balloon flies over into Israel, it will stop. It will start dropping pieces of flaming material in several spots instead of one.
Oh no.
It gets worse and worse.
And this is just right
at the
border.
These people are just evil. Hamas is an evil organization. It's a terrorist organization. Their aim is to kill Jews, period. They want to annihilate the Jewish population of Israel and take it over and turn it back into a desert.
I mean, that's just chilling. But I want to move to some other areas in the region, if you can help us. I know there are some sanctions that are going against Iran. What are these all about that you're aware of?
Well, we have had sanctions on Iran for some time, and certainly since we got out of the agreement, that terrible agreement that Barack Obama and John Kerry had signed with Iran, essentially guaranteed that they would have nuclear weapons in 10 years. But in any case, what we're trying to do, what the President Trump is trying to do, and the reason he got out of that agreement is because he is trying to pressure Iran not to develop their nuclear capabilities, which they were doing, by the way, under the Obama administration, but they were doing it in North Korea. They were hiding their activities by doing it by partnering with the North Korean government. And they did quite a lot of development over there. But in the meantime, this past June, Pompeo, our Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, announced that the Financial Action Task Force had responded to Iran's failure to address something else that we don't talk about very much, but they have a systematic process of money laundering and terrorist financing. They pay for terrorism from Hamas and from Hezbollah and so forth. And so in order to do that, they added sanctions, which would help to interrupt the flow of funding to terrorist organizations. And it actually had an impact almost immediately. These sanctions denied the leadership of access to financial resources. But now what's happening is the president has added sanctions in an executive order, which was on the June 24th, which imposed sanctions on the supreme leader of Iran and the office of the supreme and his office. It further allowed the Secretary of the Treasury, the United States Secretary of Treasury, to impose sanctions on other officials who were appointed to their positions by the supreme leader. And what these will do would be to deny him and his coterie of people that he appointed, would deny him access to the financial resources and block them from using any part of United States financial system or accessing any assets which they have in the United States. And that is something that has never been done before, that he personally has been sanctioned.
Okay, so we're talking about electronic interceptions. In other words, realize there is a system in how the money moves around the world. And that's big to do something like that. Now, Obama sent pallets of cash and other monies to Iran. Has any of that money ever been accounted for? Or was it just free money?
I don't know that it's ever been accounted for. Well, I'll tell you where some of it went. Some of it went to Hamas, some of it went to Hezbollah. Some of it went into their nuclear development process. Very little of it went into the economy itself or to the Iranian people who are really suffering. The local economy, meaning the civilian economy, is doing very, very badly and doing worse now because of the sanctions. But that's not where their interest lies. The government, led by the Ayatollahs, are interested in their ideological mission, which is to create a new caliphate that is Shia, not Sunni, and which they're expecting the man they call the Mahdi, who is going to be the 12th Imam, to come and essentially establish a global caliphate. Their mission. So anything they can do to forward that, to support terrorist organizations and to support terrorist countries or terrorist supporting countries, they will do.
I know that recently a very expensive drone aircraft was shot down by the Iranians. And there are movements now by the United States military into the area. What can you tell us about these movements and what is being moved?
Well, we've sent several battle groups, the 3rd Fleet in the Mediterranean to the 5th Fleet in the Gulf of Oman and the Persian Gulf. And what we've done, the last one, I think, was the USS Abraham Lincoln battle group. But there are several there. And the USS Abraham Lincoln and one other were sent from the Mediterranean through the Suez Canal, on the Saudi Arabian Peninsula, and into the Gulf of Oman. And the purpose of doing this is to send a warning to Iran that America is able and willing to stop them from developing a nuclear capability which would arm them and allow them to basically threaten the world with military nuclear power, with nuclear bombs.
And also ballistics, right? Because you have to have a delivery system as well,
well
as
that's
the
what they
weapon.
Yes, that's one of the things they were developing in North Korea, was their ballistic system.
So now we have, you know, the summits that are going to be happening in North Korea. And if that's true, that can't make the Iranians very happy if Trump succeeds with North Korea. So, I mean, it's like everybody's playing everybody else, but it's all related. It's very confusing.
Well, it is confusing because there's a lot that goes on behind the scenes that we don't know about. For example, we thought we had something going on with North Korea a long time ago. I mean, it was almost a year ago when Trump met with Kim Jong-un. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, it stopped going anywhere and Trump walked out of the meeting and there were no more negotiations. And there was some indication that North Korea was still active in its nuclear program. This is a complicated story because they had a big failure when the mountain they were doing all their testing in started to collapse. And that's pretty much when Iran left the program or left most of it anyway. We don't know what they're doing over there now. But the problem is that these different players, Iran, Russia, China, North Korea, they're doing a lot of stuff that we don't know about. They're active in a lot of these political games, international political games that we know nothing about. So we come to the table and we're meeting with China and we're meeting with North Korea now. And we don't really know what goes on behind the scenes. So it's very difficult for us to understand what's going to happen next because we don't know what they're plotting that they're keeping from us, that they don't want us to know. Now, we've got very good intelligence. For those of us who are on the outside looking in, it is very confusing indeed. There are a lot of players, there are a lot of moving pieces, and we just don't know who is doing what at the very most, at the very deepest levels.
Unreal. On that note, we're going to take a short break.
Patriots. Through his widely acclaimed poetry books, The Trump Chronicle, Ray Ray has preserved for us these historic events that have surrounded the first 2 years of the Trump presidency. His fervent and patriotic poems capture in real time what could have easily been lost or forgotten. The Trump Chronicle is available on Amazon or through the America Out Loud bookstore. Pick up a few of these memorable books for your library. They are a must-have for our MAGA movement. Let's support this important patriotic poet and show host so we can continue to read history through poetry.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep, but it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount or call 844-869-9958.
As we say, let the silent voices be heard. Shadow banning, editing, censorship, blocking, and adherence to political correctness are seen as serious threats to our God-given right to free speech. Suppressing free speech, the very cornerstone of our society, is not in the best interest of our listeners, readers, and those who provide our content. Welcome to the new era in communications. America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Ilana, I read about a top-ranking Saudi diplomat that said that the blood conflict between Israel and the Arab world had lasted too long and that the time for normalization had come. And something to the effect of, you know, us Saudis and the Gulf states plus Egypt and Jordan realize that the age of going to war with Israel is over. If this is true, What are your thoughts about this?
Well, it is true. And it's not only Saudi Arabia now. It's not only Saudi Arabia now. It is Bahrain, where the head of the Bahrainian government said that Israel is part of the Middle East, and it's here to stay. And it's time for us to create the bridges that will bring about peace in the long run. And Israel is, it doesn't mean that they're going to establish an embassy in Jerusalem, but they did talk about an embassy in what they call Palestine. So this is very interesting. This is groundbreaking. And this is why the meeting in Bahrain was so important, even though it may not lead to a peace treaty between the Palestinians and the Israelis, even though it may not lead to any kind of sort of resolution between the Palestinians and the Israelis, it was a way to open the doors to more normalized relations between Israel and some of its Arab neighbors. And that is a big deal.
Well, he also emphasized that, you know, Israel had been made tremendous technological advances over the last 20 or 30 years. I mean, items that we as Americans utilize every day, most people don't know they originated in Israel. Can you tell us about some of the technological advances? And you foresaw this.
Well, I did. When I was in Israel, I lived in Israel for 16 years. And part of what I was doing there was to help Israeli companies connect with American investors. And some of the projects that I worked on then have become part of what we know as the technology that we use all the time. Medical technology, such as, you know, the little cameras that go onto the tubes when you get a colonoscopy or an endoscopy. They were developed in Israel, and I saw the early development. One of my clients was developing these cameras, and I saw them at work when I was there. And this was maybe 15, 20 years ago, but this was where it all came from. The MRI tech, some of the MRI technology was developed in Israel and Haifa. Getting to another industry, IM, instant messaging, was developed in Israel. Components of your computer, your Intel processor, the microprocessor that goes into some of the earlier computers, they were developed in Israel. Many of the medical devices that we take for granted that test us for significant diseases, 3D mammography, that was being developed in Israel, and one of my neighbors was in a company that was developing that. That's now common in America. And so forth. So even if the product itself was not brought to America under an Israeli name, the technology was sold to American companies. And so these things that we take for granted, and by the way, it's not all technology. Cherry tomatoes were developed in Israel. Did you know that?
No. And I love that.
Me too. And I love a lot of the agricultural products. They have a research and development government organization called the Volcani Institute, and they do remarkable stuff there.
What is a kibbutz?
A kibbutz is a collective community. In the early days of Israel, they were largely agricultural, and they were a collective community where everybody shared in the work and everybody shared in the whatever it is they produced. In the early days, it was more governed by European socialist theory. And so the children lived in a children's house. They didn't live with their parents, their parents were given a place to live, and they ate in the community dining room and so forth. The community dining room still exists in kibbutzim, but they're largely, and there are agricultural kibbutzim, which is the plural of kibbutz, but many of the kibbutzim have become industrial and have opened factories, and they're selling and they're exporting, and they become very commercial. So there is much less of the socialism going on.
And more capitalism.
It's more capitalism. That's right.
That's very interesting. You know, the other aspect this Saudi diplomat was talking about was that the Israelis have fundamentally exposed some of the Iranian rhetoric. In other words, this distortion about what's truly going on in Islam. I mean, in some of the little research that I've done, one of the key tenets of Islam is this concept of taqiyya, which is very interesting because as a Jew, that word is very similar to when they blow the shofar, you know, on New Year. It's called, you know what I'm talking about a lot.
Yes.
We call it, but they also, because people have to understand Arabic, Hebrew, these languages have very common roots. So there are words that are common to both of these civilizations, so to say, or ideologies. So this word taqiyya in Islam fundamentally says that you're allowed to lie or deceive a non-Muslim. So exposing some of these distortions is important.
Yeah, for the purpose of protecting Islam, saving a life, protecting another Muslim against a non-Muslim, taqiyya is acceptable. Taqiyya is lying, and it's acceptable as a principle in Islam in order to protect Islam or protect a Muslim. And it's a concept we're not really clear about, and we don't take it very seriously because it doesn't seem to make sense to the Western mind. But you know, when you study the impact that Islam is having on our society, it is enormous and it's subversive, and it's something that we need to pay attention to. I actually wrote a book about it called Hamas Care and the Muslim Brotherhood, The Plot to Destroy America. Mm. And this is not conspiracy theory. The book itself is about 110 pages. It's heavily documented because I wanted the reader to be very clear that this is not about conspiracy theory. This is about conspiracy against America. And a guy by the name of Abdurrahman Alamoudi, who was an American who came here, lived in Boston for a while, went to Washington, and made quite a name for himself and was friends with presidents and frequent visitors to the White House and to Congress, and then went to federal prison for his role in a terrorist plot. Mm. But he once said to a Chicago rally, "It may not happen this year. It may not happen in 100 years, but this will be a Muslim country." And that, Ray, is what this is all about. That's
really
what my book is all about, is the effort to make this a Muslim country. And if you look at what's happening in Congress now.
Yes.
With Ilhan Omar.
Yes.
And Rashida Tlaib. Mm-hmm. You know, this is very, very scary stuff, and we need to pay attention.
Question: how did you become an intelligence analyst?
Well, first of all, as I said, I lived in Israel. I was there for 16 years. And at the beginning, I was working as an editor. And my clients were, you know, Canadian Pacific Tales was one of my clients, for example. And I wrote their in-house publication, you know, the magazine that's given to all the guests and so forth. So that was my first real job there. And then later on, I began working in what was later called business intelligence, but at the time, that industry didn't exist, and so it was just called marketing. But what I did was essentially do intelligence for industry, mm-hmm. having them to see what their markets are, particularly in the United States. So that was how I got started in the intelligence business, and it didn't take long for me to undergo various kinds of training. I don't want to be too specific, but
no, I know.
Undergo various kinds of training that brought me into the counterterrorism arena.
Let me ask you, what is it about Jews in Israel that there are enemies hell-bent on their destruction? I know it's
You mean
a tough
Jewish
question.
Enemies?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't have an answer for you. Why is it, for example, that so many Jews are aligning themselves with organizations like BDS and other, you know, campus organizations that are basically anti-Israel? I can't give you an answer, because the only thing I can say is that they have been essentially brainwashed by our educational system. I have a lot to say about the way children are educated in America today, and we don't have time for it, but right. I do believe that they are being brought up to be unrealistic about life. They don't learn history. They don't even learn grammar. They don't learn good English, so they have to make up their own language. And they are coming into the adult world with very skewed ideas about what life is about, what they are entitled to. I mean, these are kids who are brought up to believe that nothing, that no one is better than anybody else, and that if you, that competition is bad, and that if you show up, you get a prize. You don't need to compete. You don't need to be better than anybody else. And this really creates an environment for our kids where they cannot function in the real world, because real life is competitive.
Yes.
And in real life, there are winners and losers. And in real life, you have to stand up. You have to do more than just show up. You are not entitled to anything that you don't earn. But now we have all these young people, the millennials, who are coming and say, we're entitled. We want free this. We want free this, free that. And guess what? We have a panel of 20 socialists running for president on the Democrat side. It's astonishing, really, and it's terrifying.
It really is astonishing. And you know, yeah, I worry about...
God forbid. No, I was just going to say, and God forbid any one of these people who want to give us free everything gets to be president of the United States, our country is going to fail.
It's really something else. And you know, we're talking about the possibilities of a lasting peace in the Middle East, and you know, and look at the unrest we have within our own borders. You know, somebody recently told me that, you know, you got to understand that the enemies lie within. And that's our biggest problem facing our country. And we're getting blindsided. And returning Donald Trump to the White House in 2020, in my opinion, will be even a bigger challenge and a necessary result, even greater than 2016. You know, I want to just ask you in the last few minutes to tell us about your books and where we can purchase them.
Okay, well, I have written 4 books, all on Islamic terrorism. The 2 most recent ones, I think, are the 2 most important ones. They're both about Hamas. The first is about, it's called Hamas, the story of Islamic Jihad on Israel's front lines. And it's about Hamas in Gaza. It was actually the first book, although it was published second, it was actually the first book in the series of 2. Because it tells about how Hamas started, and it tells about how it has operated, about its corruption, about how it has in fact destroyed Gaza in order to enrich itself, and it really tells about what the threat to Israel is, and it's a serious threat. The second book is about Hamas. It's called Hamas. The second book is called Hamas Care and the Muslim Brotherhood: The Plot to Destroy America. And it's interesting because the same year that Hamas was founded in Gaza, the organization sent people here to the United States to develop a fundraising mechanism. And this book tells about how this fundraising mechanism was created. It was created through a network of scores of organizations, not-for-profit organizations, regular companies doing business, and foundations. And all of these companies and organizations were used to funnel money to Hamas through the Channel Islands offshore England, and then to the Hamas or terrorist organization. So that's what these two books are about. The second book talks about the threat in America of these Muslim organizations who are determined to make the United States a Muslim country. And that's the plot.
Wow. You know, Alana, I want to thank you, and I want to thank Yankee Farber for continuing to enlighten us on these issues. And what I find so, you know, hard is that while we're talking about issues that emanate 7,000, 5,000 miles away, we're seeing it come within our borders. We're seeing it in our own Congress. We're seeing it at the border. God knows who's coming through our southern border that have been funneled from the Middle East. We don't know who these people are. And this is the bottom line of this. We need sovereignty and we need peace. I don't know if we'll see peace in the Middle East. And the way things are going in the United States, we're going to see some major conflicts over this border if we can't get this straightened out. But I want to thank you for coming on. I want for you and Yankee to be regular contributors as we move through time, and how it, what the implications are to the 2020 election. So on that note, love Ray Ray and a poem.